Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Bradfield, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is January 24, 2023. This panel of the court today has five cases on its agenda, three of which will be submitted with oral argument, and two of which will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. For the first case is number A22-806, Rachel Royer versus Inventive Health and the Department of Employment and Economic Development. As counsel know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. We have multiple lecterns. The one in the middle is the one we've used in the past. The others were set up during the COVID era. The one in the middle has, you can take your pick, the one in the middle has the light system, green, yellow, and red. It also has a button on the front edge that can adjust the height with an electric motor. On the appellant side, Mr. Boyd, are you arguing for appellant?
No, Your Honor. We have a student who's been certified to argue this morning, Stephen Royer, or excuse me, Stephen
okay.
Vogel.
and I did not see a motion on the docket for leave to have the student certified student attorney argue.
It was my recollection that when we appeared, we asked leave to file formal briefs as well as to have the student certified and to appear for argument.
I should say I didn't see a recent order. So you're saying that was ruled upon at an earlier stage?
I believe so, and I think okay. The requirement is that I attend. So I'm here to attend to be available, but Mr. Vogel will argue with the court's permission.
Yeah, understood. So we will assume that that order is in the file, and if it's not, I will hereby grant your oral motion for permission for Mr. Vogel to order.
Yeah. Thank you.
I hope I didn't affect your blood pressure there.
No. For the,
I'm the one who prepared.
Okay, counsel for appellant, you may approach and begin. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may present your argument.
Good morning, Judge Bradfield, Judge Johnson, and Judge Bryan. May it please this court. My name is Stephen Vogel, and I represent the relator, Ms. Rachel Royer. We request that this court reverse the ULJ's findings of ineligibility and remand with instructions to reinstate Ms. Royer's benefits. This case is about an employee who followed the rules as presented and expected her employer to do the same. With employment misconduct, the critical issues are one, whether Syneos, her employer, had reasonable expectations, and two, if so, whether Ms. Royer followed these reasonable expectations. The first part of Syneos' policy, requiring vaccines except for religious exemptions, was reasonable. Ms. Royer followed this by requesting and Syneos granting a religious exemption. The second part, not accommodating Ms. Royer's religious beliefs by inadequately claiming undue hardship, was unreasonable because Syneos provided no evidence of any hardship. So in the first part, the expectation was reasonable and it was followed. In the second part, the expectation was unreasonable and it was not followed. Neither of these constitutes unemployment misconduct. So Ms. Royer is entitled to unemployment benefits.
Mr. Vogel, is it your position that the undue burden test or the law concerning undue burden is incorporated into our state statutory definition of misconduct?
Do you mean undue hardship, Your Honor?
Excuse me, undue hardship.
Thank you. So our position on that is that It is very likely that Syneos used the terminology of undue hardship and religious exemptions to comply with Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. However, there is no case law incorporating that officially into the Minnesota body of case law.
Well, let me rephrase my question. I mean, I take it from your brief. I think there's a section of your brief arguing that your second heading says the evidence fails to establish that providing Ms. Royer with a reasonable accommodation would have imposed an undue hardship on Syneos. Why is that relevant? Why is that part of our consideration here today?
Right. So the first part of that answer involves we have to look at their policy in two separate steps, in two stages of their policy. That's because with employment misconduct, the critical inquiry is, you know, were the expectations reasonable and were they followed? And that changed at different points of their policy and its administration. So in the first part, she followed it by being granted the religious exemption and applying for it. That leaves the only disputed area here is whether or not, you know, she was terminated for undue hardship in a reasonable manner. And that's why undue hardship, which is the reason Syneos gave in their own policy, which is what matters according to the statute, that's what really the only true legal issue is in front of us, Your Honor.
So the department argued at page 23 of its brief that the undue hardship issue is not relevant.
I believe they did, yes, Your Honor.
And they had some reasons why, but I guess do you have any rebuttal argument to that?
I do. So to start off with the first issue of sincerely held beliefs and why that is not relevant, and then I'll go into why undue hardship is relevant. Sincerely held religious beliefs, that was never at issue. She was not terminated because she did not have sincerely held religious beliefs. So that was never in dispute. It was never questioned by the employer. The employer had multiple opportunities to weigh in front of this court and in briefs, and they declined. So on the record alone, she was fired not for the sincerely held beliefs, but she was fired for, according to Syneos, undue hardship. According to the statute itself, what matters is, I'll just read the statute. It's a serious violation of the standards of behavior the employer has the right to reasonably expect of the employee. So what matters there is the employer's expectations, not the ULJ's independent opinion. So on that and the fact that the ULJ has no case, or sorry, the deed has no case law involving a case like ours where, you know, it was undisputed between the employer and employee and they readily accepted the sincerity of the employee's beliefs.
Well, I think my question was not really about, I didn't intend for my question to get into the subject of sincerely held religious
my
beliefs.
Apologies, Your Honor.
It was more about undue hardship.
Right, sorry.
Which is, it's part of the federal law, I believe, of Title VII and,
right.
Discrimination based on religion and so on. I'm just wondering why that is relevant here today in a state court proceeding about unemployment benefits. And I mean, your opposing counsel says it's not relevant. Seems to me you might take that invitation and snap it up and say, all right, there's one less obstacle between us and the goal line. I'm just wondering why you insist on raising that and making it an issue making it an issue of proof before the ULJ, I believe, if I understand your position.
That is a good point, Your Honor, in the sense that we don't believe that the undue hardship component of it actually constituted employment misconduct, so we would agree that is yet another reason why she should be granted benefits. But we do believe it's worth discussing in the sense that this is really the true issue before the court. It's really the only disputed matter before the court.
Which issue is that?
The issue of undue hardship. And it is relevant in a state context because we have to look at, in terms of employment misconduct, you know, were the expectations reasonable? So there's two ways to look at that. You can assume, you know, they were using the language of Title VII, but even if that doesn't apply, it's still under the plain meaning of the statute with terms of reasonable expectations and whether or not she followed them, it was still unreasonable expectation because there was no evidence of undue hardship by any interpretation of that phrase. And so we should look at, so the evidence actually states to the contrary. Ms. Royer was effectively working for AbbVie Pharmaceuticals as, you know, a solely employee for them. And they never once complained about her. They had their own employees in her exact same role who were given the very same accommodations that she requested.
So if I can jump in here, because you're talking about the accommodations that she requested, the exemption she received.
Yes.
What exactly was the accommodation she requested? What was the exemption that she received?
So she applied for an exemption.
To do what?
To not get the vaccine, Your Honor.
Okay, and ultimately, what exemption did she receive ultimately?
She received an exemption to not receive the vaccine, withstanding they would still have to do a second part check in terms of whether they could accommodate that religious belief that they granted the exemption for.
Well, I mean, it sounds like to me what they said was, okay for now, but that's not our final decision. We'll give you our final decision later. And the final decision was no exemption. So no, that's why I'm asking the question, based on what it was presented to the ULJ, what exemption or accommodation did she receive or was made?
So if you look at that letter where they, I think it was an October 6th letter. I don't have the exact record site. However, they, in their own terms, they accepted the religious exemption. They accepted the validity of her sincerely held beliefs. And so...
But they didn't exempt her from the requirement of getting a vaccine. Ultimately, they required it, right?
I would argue that the exemption is the terminology they used. She applied for the exemption, and they granted it. So regardless of what you and I think in terms of, you know...
And you don't make a distinction between a temporary exemption and like a permanent one or some that's in the interim versus a forever exemption?
I think no matter if it's temporary or forever, at the end of the day, it was a two-part according to their own policy. And according to the statute, the employer determines, you know, did they meet their expectations? And so their expectations, as they laid out, was this two-part factor test in terms of, first, you have to apply for the exemption in their own words, in their own form. It's not like we're, you know, creating that from scratch and lying about that. And then the second part is, you know, can we accommodate?
So let me ask a question about the way you're reading the statute to...
Yes.
Imply there's some deference that the ULJ must give to the employer's determination of some facts,
yes,
as opposed to being an independent fact finder themselves. I didn't see case law or authority to support that. I hear you today, your authority is the statute, and there's some language in the statute that you rely on to reach that conclusion. Apart from that, have we ever held this? Has the Supreme Court ever held this? Is there any? Okay.
No, Your Honor.
So the follow-up then is, yes, are you asking us to, if we agree with you, to publish this case and develop the law to make it clear that we are interpreting the statute to require the ULJ to defer to the employer, even when the department disputes a fact?
So
it seems like that's the point of law you want us to reach. Is that because you keep saying there's no dispute. Well, there is a dispute. I'm sure opposing counsel will stand up and dispute some of the things you say aren't in dispute because there's a difference between the employer and their role in these proceedings and the department and its role, right? So
right,
the question then becomes, for me, the rule of law you want us to adopt is to interpret the statute in such a way as to require the ULJ to defer to the employer's determination of some factual issue, even when the department deed disputes that fact.
Yes, so regardless, there's a few things there. Regardless of whether or not you publish or unpublish, this is a rare and novel setting in a sense. You know, we have the case, we have the statute, and I would say that that is determinative unto itself. There is no case law from our standpoint. There is no case law from their standpoint. There is no case law that Deed can cite where the ULJ unilaterally overturned what the employer said. A lot of these cases are where the employer disputed the finding, and that's why the employee was terminated. That was the reason they appeared in court for the ULJ to decide. In terms of is the ULJ bound by the employer's determination? Well, it depends on what was disputed, because if a matter's disputed, then it's relevant to the case and the ULJ has the authority to decide the matter. For the first part, the sincerity of beliefs was never at issue. The employer found that she was eligible. It wasn't.
And you say it's not at issue.
Right.
I think opposing counsel might have a different viewpoint of that. Certainly the ULJ thought it was at issue, because the ULJ did talk about what it thought was disputed and determined sincerely held beliefs was at issue, and then went ahead and said there's multiple reasons here. Some are secular. The one that's religious is not credible. So if the ULJ was correct to frame it that way, then it seems we have some well-established rules of, regarding our standards of review on credibility that we'd have to apply.
Yes, if it was disputed, but again, that is not how the actual case, the statute reads. And again, there is no case law determining either way, so it is up for this court to decide how they want to interpret the statute.
If there's case law that says the ULJ is the independent finder of fact.
That's a good question. So
is that enough to say they don't have to defer to an employer's view of the fact?
No, Your Honor. The ULJ is the fact finder, yes. But like any judge, they cannot overturn undisputed facts that are irrelevant to the matter of why they're in court there. And so we have a case of the ULJ essentially deciding on the wrong issue. If it was the right issue, if it was based on why she was terminated, then yes, absolutely. The ULJ would have a reason to determine fact matters that are relevant to this case.
Mr. Vogel, is there any, I'm switching topics a little bit, is there any evidence in the record about the drug Comirnaty? I don't know how to pronounce that. Is there any evidence in the record as to whether that drug was based on fetal cell lines?
I am not aware of that, Your Honor.
No.
Either way. That is what Ms. Royer claimed. I forget about which particular drug, but in terms of the vaccine, I know she claimed and the employer accepted the fact that she objected as one of her reasons was that there was fetal cells included in the vaccine.
Well, I think in some vaccines, but then she was interested in the possibility of that particular drug, and the ULJ commented on that, but I think based on an assumption that fetal cell lines were used to develop that drug, but I'm
not aware of offhand, Your Honor, about that particular drug. I can only speak to that. So I realize I'm out of time.
Time has expired, right, but you will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you may approach and introduce yourself and your client and then begin.
Okay. Excuse me. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I represent respondent, Department of Employment and Economic Development. So this case turns on whether the relator had a sincerely held religious belief that prevented her from getting a COVID vaccine. And the ULJ based her findings on the evidence that she had in the record that she developed, which was the relator's written submissions. And the ULJ found that she did not have such a belief. This finding is supported by relator's written statements and the ULJ's credibility determination. Therefore, Deed requests that the court affirm. If the court finds that the evidence is insufficient to support the finding or would like the ULJ to further develop the record on the issue of sincerity, then remand is appropriate for further development.
Ms. Phillips, you argue at pages 12 to 14 of your brief about credibility. I mean, did the ULJ make an express determination that she was not credible?
She did.
Can you point that out for me?
Sure.
I know that on page, RA8 of your addendum, there's a statement, there's no credible evidence.
Okay, yeah, so I'm looking at, it's page 4 of the initial decision. And she says, this is the third paragraph, although Royer also mentioned in her written request to Cineas that the use of any injection containing cell lines from an aborted fetus was an affront to her God and her beliefs, her other statements weaken the credibility of this claim. So she's looking at the credibility of her written statements and reasoning that...
says it weak, and I think that's the only use of the word credible or credibility. It weakens the credibility. So you're relying on that as being an express finding that she was not credible?
Yes, yes. The written statement regarding the sincerity of her beliefs is not credible because it's inconsistent with other statements, other parts of her written statements. So she kind of goes...
There's no determination that her oral testimony was not credible?
Right. There's no determination that her oral testimony lacked credibility. The judge just notes that she refused to answer questions, and that's about it. So it doesn't get into the credibility of her testimony.
So the remainder of that paragraph, I think she explains maybe the next. An individual who was genuinely opposed to the vaccines on religious grounds because it used fetal cell lines, blah, 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 would not seek assistance to find a particular brand of it. When I read that, it sounds like the ULJ believed that Comirnaty used fetal cell lines and therefore that Ms. Royer was being inconsistent. But I guess... when I read Ms. Royer's prior statement, I thought that that she was interested in this other drug because it was different from the others.
Okay.
Is there any evidence in the record about that?
Yeah, I would, go to her statement, her written statement, the other thing that the ULJ looked at, where she describes requesting help finding Comirnaty. And she says...
So the only evidence is what's in her statement.
That's right. The only evidence is what's in her written statement. And I believe she says, I requested assistance in finding Comirnaty so I could review the clinical studies or the information about safety and efficacy. She didn't mention the fetal cell lines in relation to her request for that information. So I read it, and I think the ULJ read it, as saying she wanted that information to review clinical studies, safety and efficacy, and then, so the judge reasoned, somebody who was genuinely opposed to taking that vaccine because of the use of fetal cell lines wouldn't have, gone through the step of looking at those safety and efficacy issues. So that's the substance of the credibility determination on the written statements.
If I can follow up, because at the end of the paragraph, there's the use of the word statements, plural. To the extent she provided any testimony, it was inconsistent with her other statements and not believable. But if you look at the paragraph, I think there's only one statement quoted. Yet the conclusion says statements, plural. Are there other statements elsewhere in the written decision or elsewhere in the testimony that you think would fall under this language of plural, or was that just an oversight and there really is only the one statement?
I read that to include her written exemption request to Cineas, which is in the record, and then her written statement to Deed.
And what about, let's break those apart, starting with the written request. What about that request would support or would be inconsistent with a sincerely held belief about fetal cell lines?
Sure. So,
the same question as it relates to the testimony.
Okay. So the exemption request, Exhibit 5, page 7, is the ULJ reasons that it's focused on the safety and efficacy concerns. And so these are the concerns that are similar to those in the Logue decision, which is also a non-precedential decision, but it was recently issued and dealt with a vaccine requirement similar to this one. And so it's the similar type of reasoning that these are primarily concerns about safety and efficacy. You'll see that there are some statements about the Bible. There are some Bible verses there. But the ULJ's reasoning is these are primarily safety and efficacy concerns. Therefore, you know, it doesn't support a sincerely held religious belief. And then, I'm sorry, Judge Brian, what was the second part of your question?
I think you said there were two separate things. One was the written statement, and then I believe you said her testimony, but I'm not at this point confident in my recollection of what you said. So if there is another piece, I just want to know what other statements might be inconsistent with
the
this.
Yeah, the other statement is the written statement, which is it's on Exhibit 6, page 5, and it's a kind of a numbered statement that she wrote to Deed, kind of describing some of the efforts that she went through when she was going through this exemption process. And she talks about contacting Cineas multiple times for safety studies, for safety and efficacy clinical studies that are peer-reviewed. She wants some specific information about whether it is safe and effective. That's paragraph 5, kind of she goes into that. And then she says, and along with that, there's not sufficient liability protection of the person being injected with the experimental injections, as I requested that information from the company and noted to them that manufacturers are not held liable. So she is making statements that she's concerned with safety and efficacy, with liability. And so the judge, takes those statements from these two written statements.
An inference then, right? Making the inference that if there was some statement from the employer acknowledging liability, or if there was some additional science, you think that would have taken care of those concerns, and that's the inference you have to make as to why this other reason about fetal cell lines is not sincerely held.
That's right. Okay, I think that's the ULJ's reasoning in that credibility determination.
On the issue of sincerely held religious beliefs, I mean, why is it necessary for the department and for the ULJ to inquire into that if the employer and employee agree that it is sincerely held? And I guess, I'd like you to answer that with reference to the statute, which talks about, you know, employment misconduct make somebody ineligible if they were discharged because of employment misconduct. And so it seems like the employer's motivation for the discharge is central to the statute. And then the definition of misconduct is a serious violation of the standards of behavior the employer has the right to reasonably expect. So if the employer has certain standards for what is acceptable and what isn't. Why should the department second guess that?
Okay, so the analysis of employment misconduct that the ULJ applied here is one that's also seen in case law, in Logue most recently, in Potter, and also in the U.S. Supreme Court case, Frazee. And the way the employment misconduct analysis works is this. So you look at first the employers, whether they have a reasonable expectation. So here the expectation is for all employees, all public-facing employees, to get a COVID-19 vaccine. The relator, violated that expectation by not getting a vaccine. If relator had a sincerely held religious belief, however, that is not employment misconduct that would make her ineligible for benefits. And that analysis, like I said, is in Potter, it's in Logue.
I got the sense in Potter and Logue that the employer did not believe that it was a sincerely held religious belief. And so that was disputed between the employer and the employee, and that was the basis of the discharge.
You're correct with regard to Potter. I think in Potter, the employer did.
In Logue, it appears silent, I think. We're unsure.
That's right. That's right. In Logue, the relator applied for an exemption, and the court notes that and then it doesn't, the facts don't, you know, let us know what the employer determined. But both of those cases say that this is a fact question that for the ULJ to analyze. So we do have this employer determination somewhere in Logue, but the court doesn't mention it because it's not the employer's job to make that factual call. The court says it's a fact question for the ULJ, and the court then analyzes, you know, the ULJ's finding, is it supported by the evidence?
Well, but that makes sense if it were disputed, and I think we're unsure about the one case, but disputed between the employer and employee. But if it's not.
Yeah.
Another question, so the statutory definition, standards of behavior, the employer has a right to reasonably expect of the employee. Would you agree the word reasonably there incorporates the provisions of Title VII? In other words, an employer cannot reasonably expect an employee to follow a policy if the employee has sincerely held religious beliefs. That would be in conflict with it?
So no, I don't believe the language incorporates Title VII in any way. Case law does say repeatedly that the focus of the employment misconduct inquiry is on the employee's conduct. And, you know, there's cases that discuss, you know, whether the employer followed this policy in the correct way, whether the employer, you know, isn't relevant to that inquiry. So here, whether Syneos could have, you know, preserved the employment by accommodating her isn't relevant. The evidence in the record supports the finding that the relator was discharged because she didn't get a vaccine, and Syneos said that to her, you know, in the final email. So the question then is whether that refusal is employment misconduct, and the case law tells us that turns on whether she had a sincerely held religious belief.
So is it your position that in this case the employer, do you concede that the employer, I guess that the employer agreed or the employer conceded it was religious, sincerely held?
Yes, so the employer did state in an email that it found that she had a sincerely held religious belief. So,
but then the employer goes on to deny the request, essentially, just like you mentioned in Logue, I think, where the employer denied this request. So ultimately, if the employer says, we have a vaccine requirement, it doesn't matter at all whether you have a sincerely held belief and we think you do. Is that how you think the employer made this decision?
Well, we don't really know how the employer made the decision.
I shouldn't have said that. Do you think that the employer, in this case, if they agreed it was sincerely held, but then denied the request and required a vaccine, essentially what they're saying is it doesn't matter. There is no exemption possible, even if it's sincerely held. We don't care.
Yes, that's how I interpret the employer's response is we can't accommodate this, even if you have a sincerely held religious
belief. If that is the response, is there any requirement that the employer then show why they are disregarding a sincerely held belief? Do they have to show some undue hardship?
I believe they do in other, you know, areas of law, you know, in the employment.
Sure, wrongful termination.
Right, sure.
But I'm saying in this context, in order for us to affirm that there was employee misconduct, does Deed or the employer have to demonstrate some reason why they would disregard what the employer had determined was sincerely held?
No, we don't need that information to analyze the issue of whether the relator was discharged due to employment misconduct. That kind of information
doesn't to the reasonableness of the policy?
I don't think so. I mean, it goes to how the employer is implementing the policy, perhaps, but the policy is that it expects every employee who is a public-facing employee to get the vaccine. And so in cases like this, the court has analyzed, is that a reasonable expectation? And the court has reasoned it is reasonable because it's implemented to protect safety of other employees, of customers. In a decision issued last week, the court reasoned it's reasonable because it's based on CDC guidance, and we defer to the CDC. You know, here we don't. We don't have that information of whether it was based on CDC guidance. We can look that up. But we can say that it's reasonable because the employer kind of grounded it in safety concerns. And that was the analysis that the ULJ did. It's consistent with case law, and that's the correct analysis.
Judge Johnson, if I may follow up. I know we're out of time, so I'm happy to
leave it here. Yes, you may. Go ahead.
If what you end with is telling us it doesn't matter whether it's sincerely held, because what we're looking at is a policy that requires vaccination, regardless of people's religious beliefs, reasonable? And your argument is, yes, it is reasonable. Look at the case from last week. Then why isn't that all we do is to say, we have a policy here that makes no exception for religious beliefs. That's reasonable. We don't need to address sincerely held, right?
Because we have the case law that says you can't deny someone unemployment benefits if they're choosing their religious beliefs over their employment. So if this decision was based on a sincerely held religious belief, it cannot be employment misconduct. We cannot hold her ineligible. But that's kind of a separate prong of the employment misconduct analysis. And reading it that way, I think, is consistent with the case law we have. We look at whether that policy is reasonable for all employees, and then we say, does this applicant or does this relator have a sincerely held religious belief? If she does, it's not employment misconduct and she's eligible. So ultimately, the case does turn on whether she had a sincerely held religious belief.
Thank you, Ms. Phillips.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Vogel, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. The first point I'd like to mention is that the employer set their own standard. It is the employer's expectations. They said in their policy, can I have that actually? Sorry. Cineo stated in their October 6th letter, they said, we need to determine whether we can provide an accommodation without creating an undue hardship. That didn't come from nowhere, regardless if it came from Title VII. This is the standard they're applying. And so they set that on themselves, and we have to determine whether or not that was reasonable. And then in December 9th letter.
And why is that?
What?
Why is that? Why is that the extent of the inquiry? Why is that not something that the ULJ can inquire into further?
A couple reasons. First, it was the reason she was terminated. And as you mentioned in your question earlier, it's discharged for a reason and for unreasonable expectations. But the first part of that matters. Was she discharged for that reason?
Mr. Vogel, yes. It seems that there's different points in time that we can look to,
yes,
to decide what is the policy here or what were the expectations here. The ultimate decision was not to give someone an exemption. So in other words, the policy, I think, is correctly stated by your opposing counsel that this employer decided it didn't matter what your religious beliefs were, you have to get the vaccine.
Your Honor, we should follow the words of what they actually said. So the employer noticeably never retracted their finding. They never said, we're revoking your exemption.
But they ultimately required her to get the vaccine no matter what, right?
By not accommodating her, yes.
Right.
They said we cannot accommodate. And that aspect of it is unreasonable.
So the part of the policy, so you agree that the policy is there are no exceptions, no exemptions for religious beliefs. No matter what, everyone has to get the vaccine by this date. That's essentially the policy, and now you're saying that that is unreasonable, which I can understand the argument as to why you would argue it would be unreasonable, but that seems to be a different position than saying their policy was, we will accommodate religious beliefs.
I guess what I'm arguing is we have to look at, you know, what the employer said. And so at the end of the day, they did not say straight up, get the vaccine or else you're fired. That would be a different fact pattern. That would be a different scenario. Their vaccine policy, according to their own words, includes determinations for, hey, we would allow you to get the religious exemption as an alternative. We have to determine if there's undue hardship. So that has to be a part of the expectations. Something else I'd like to mention upon that is Deed mentioned that the focus is on the employer's the employee's behavior and not the employer's expectations. That comes from a quote out of context. It comes from Stag v. Vintage. And in that case, they focused on the employer's actions. They focused on the fact that the employer mentioned multiple times to the employee, gave verbal warnings. That case was more about them focusing on, you know, did they verbatim follow the policy outlined in their statement? But the employer's actions matter. It's how the employee knows what expectations are in front of them. So that's a big component too. And then last, I'd just like to leave you with the fact that, she was not terminated for not having sincerely held religious beliefs. She was terminated because they said, according to their own words, according to their own expectations, that they could not accommodate her sincerely held religious beliefs. And because of that, along with the purpose of this statute, is to provide unemployment benefits for employees who, at no fault of their own, who followed the rules, as she did at every point in this process, except when they were unreasonable, to get benefits. And so therefore, this court must reverse and remand. Thank you.
Mr. Vogel, I have a question about, in your reply brief, you make a point to say that you're not asserting a free exercise argument, I think.
That is correct, Your Honor. Yeah. We never said that in our opening brief or reply brief.
Why are you disavowing that? I mean, your opposing counsel cited Frazee in the responsive brief, which provides, you know, it's good case law why your client might be entitled to benefits. Why would you disavow that?
I'm confused on which statements you're. And I see I'm out of time, but I'm happy to answer your question.
Well, your opponent cited the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Frazee, where the court said that the state may not deny somebody unemployment benefits if they were discharged because of a sincerely held religious belief.
That is correct, yes.
Yeah, right. So do you, I mean...
We don't disavow that part of it. It's just we think their characterization of using the free exercise clause was... you know, not what we were arguing. Because in their response brief, that's what they alleged that we were discussing that was not the case. That statement that you mentioned from the case is accurate. And if you read it again, it focuses on was the employee terminated or discharged? I forget the exact language. And so she was not discharged or terminated for not having sincerely held beliefs. So yes, that is true. And, you know, she mentions Logan Potter, which... the matter in front of them was unabashedly the fact that she was terminated because of her sincerely held beliefs. That is not the case here. And so, again, there is no case law on this particular point, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you for your arguments. Thank you to both of you for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days.
Thank you.